Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you, Dan. You know, after an introduction like that, I should just say, are there any questions? Because I've got two things now working against me, your expectations and also the fact that I'm following Kevin Page. Kevin is such a dynamic guy and such a good speaker. So I hope that none of you were here to see Kevin, and so you won't be holding that up for comparison. Bless you. I've never actually said that in a sanctuary before. It really is a pleasure to be here. This is getting to be something that I do more and more, is having the opportunity to meet with members of the community in various places in this country and talk about corrections and criminal justice and, most importantly, social justice issues. I'm tremendously pleased to be part of this series and very grateful to the congregation for putting this series on now for 4 years. You know, being the Correctional Investigator of Canada does mean that I get the opportunity to express a lot of opinions about what's going on in corrections right now. And the Government of Canada, of course, has given me lots of opportunity to do that as well lately. It's a very ambitious criminal justice agenda that Canadians are dealing with and that has been put before Parliament over the last couple of years. So I want to look at some of those themes, and I want to explore some of those things that have been happening, and I want to do it in a particular context. Your speaker's series is subtitled The Justice System for a Just Society. When I heard this, it made me think of a number of questions. Questions about when does a consequence become an unfair punishment? Can the desire to punish ever be satisfied? At what point does the pursuit of justice look more like revenge or retribution? In answering these questions, I'm going to provide a little bit of information, a little bit of context about my role as a Correctional Investigator for Canada. I'm going to speak to the continuing relevance of prison oversight in a free and democratic society, and I'm going to draw on an analysis of who is ending up behind prison bars and why. I want to offer some thoughts about the impact of the recent legislative agenda and policy changes, and why it's so important to remember that human rights are, in fact, the cornerstone of a just justice system. If you're judging how well any society respects human rights, you'd be well served to look at how people behind bars are treated. Now, this is far from a unique insight. Reflecting on more than 25 years spent imprisoned for crimes against the state, Nelson Mandela once observed, "It is said that no one truly knows a nation until one has been inside its jails. A nation should not be judged by how it treats its highest citizens, but its lowest ones," end quote. Before Mandela made this observation, of course, Dostoevsky and Churchill famously expressed similar sentiments. Prisons are, in fact, the acid test of a society's commitment to human rights and legality. A prison system that does not operate consistent with the belief that every person, regardless of creed or color or circumstance, is a bearer of rights, is inevitably a system that tolerates abuse. By purpose and by design, prisons are largely closed to public view. They are shrouded in secrecy and security. They often house voiceless and a largely disenfranchised population. They function behind bars and barriers designed not only to keep prisoners in, but observers out. Prisons are total institutions and the ultimate expression of the state's power. Prison authorities control every aspect of a prisoner's life. Quite literally, they have the power to determine whether an inmate ever gets to see the light of day. In such a system, the potential for abuse is very real. Historically, there can be no doubt that this operating environment has masked unfairness, inequity, and even brutality from public view. The evolution of corrections in Canada is marked by alternating periods of crisis followed by reform along the way. Outside intervention by the courts, by Parliament, by independent oversight groups and external review have been necessary to ensure progress and accountability. The Office of the Correctional Investigator was established some 40 years ago during one of these crisis and reform periods. It was created in response to several disturbances that rocked Canada's penitentiary system in the 1970s, and specifically including the infamous 1971 riot at the now-closed Kingston Penitentiary. At that riot, which culminated in two inmate murders and several staff taking hostage, and the near-total destruction of a section of the facility, we learned much about what can go wrong inside a prison. Today, though 40 years removed from the Kingston Pen riot, many of the same problems that fueled that explosion are still with us. Crowding, too much time spent in cells, lack of contact with the outside world, lack of program capacity, the paucity of meaningful work experience or prison vocational skill training, and the polarization between inmates and custodial staff. Now, as correctional investigator, I have statutory authority to conduct investigations into these problems and the problems of offenders related to any decision or recommendation, act or omission of the Correctional Service of Canada. Decisions to commence or to terminate it, as well as the methods used to conduct an investigation, are entirely at my discretion. These are broad statutory authorities. I report to Parliament through the Minister of Public Safety on the individual and systemic concerns that offenders bring to my office and on the ability of the Correctional Service of Canada to implement solutions. I'm fully independent of the Correctional Service of Canada and the Department of Public Safety. My office is an oversight body, not an advocacy one. My staff does not take sides when investigating complaints. We look for compliance, we look for fairness, we look for legality. We view corrections through a human rights lens. The office is not an armchair critic of the Correctional Service of Canada. It is an essential component of the legal framework that governs federal correctional practice. On an annual basis, my office receives and addresses thousands of offender complaints, contacts, and inquiries. My team of investigators regularly visit federal institutions to meet with both offenders and staff. Last year, investigators spent collectively over 330 days inside our federal penitentiaries, and they interviewed more than 1,500 offenders. Last year, the office received and reviewed 165 cases involving incidents of significant serious inmate bodily injury or death. Over 1,400 use of force files were reviewed, including an increasing proportion where the use of force was used against inmates with significant mental health issues. I offer these comments about the role and the mandate of my office in order to establish a context for understanding my concerns about who it is that's ending up behind bars these days. The face of corrections in Canada is changing. Offenders are getting older, they are more addicted, they are more ethnically diverse, and they are more mentally disordered. 23% of the total inmate population is of Aboriginal descent, despite comprising just 4% of the Canadian population. One in five federal inmates are aged 50 or older. A significant number will require specialized and expensive care while in custody. Just under 10% of inmates are Black Canadians, almost triple their representation rate in general society. The average level of educational attainment upon admission to a federal penitentiary is grade 8. 7 out of 10 federally sentenced women report histories of sexual abuse, and 86% have been physically abused at some point in their life. Before prison, most offenders are chronically underemployed. Addiction or substance abuse afflicts 80% of offenders. Two-thirds of federal offenders were under the influence of an intoxicant when they committed their index offense. 31% of the inmate population is a carrier of hepatitis C, and 5% are HIV positive. At admission, nearly 40% of male offenders require further assessment regarding their mental health needs. 30% of women in custody have previously been hospitalized for psychiatric reasons. And one-third of inmates who are identified at admission as requiring some form of psychological or psychiatric follow-up. In fact, last year, the Correctional Service of Canada delivered at least one institutional mental health service to 48% of the total inmate population, nearly half. 47% of all Aboriginal offenders received a mental health service, and 75%, three-quarters of all women, received a mental health service last year. Reviewing this list, you can begin to understand that prison acts as a kind of barometer that allows us to measure or test the success or failure of our social policies. Clues to how we have chosen to respond to homelessness, poverty, addiction, mental illness, unemployment, vocational preparation can be found by studying the inmate population profile. The results are predictably poor when substance abuse, poverty, vulnerability, social exclusion, mental illness, and addiction are deeply inserted into the criminal justice process. The point here is that prison reflects our society. It is not separate from it. In the 10-year period between March of 2003 and March of 2013, the total federal incarcerated population grew by more than 2,100 persons, representing an overall increase of 16.5%. The demographics of this growth are interesting. The Aboriginal incarcerated population increased by 46%. Aboriginal women inmates increased by 80%. One in three federally sentenced women are now of Aboriginal heritage. Visible minority inmates, including Black, Hispanic, Asian, and East Asian, increased by 75%. The number of Caucasian inmates actually declined by 3%. In absolute and relative numbers, the proportion of the inmate population that is Caucasian has decreased from 70% in 2003 to 59% today. In other words, the recent inmate population growth is almost exclusively driven by an increasing number of Aboriginal and visible minority people behind bars. For the two fastest growing groups in federal custody, Aboriginal and Black Canadians, correctional results are especially concerning. These groups are overrepresented in maximum security institutions and segregation placements. They are more likely to be subject to a use of force intervention, and they incur a disproportionate number of institutional disciplinary charges. They are released later in their sentence, and they are less likely to be granted conditional release or day or full parole. Canada's experience with its Aboriginal people demonstrates that grossly disproportionate incarceration rates suggest a legacy of failed assimilation policies, the residential school experience, the child welfare and adoption systems that continue even today to scoop up Aboriginal children, the creation of reserves, which led to the dislocation and the dispossession of so many First Nations people. The Royal Commission on Aboriginal People concluded nearly 20 years ago that the disproportionate involvement of Aboriginal people in Canada's criminal justice system speaks to a people's loss of culture, identity, and spirit. More than a decade ago, in 2001, in the Speech from the Throne, the Government of Canada committed, and I quote, to significantly reduce the percentage of Aboriginal people entering the criminal justice system. so that within a generation, it is no higher than the Canadian average, end quote. Very ambitious considering the 6 or 7 generations that the residential schools operated and the intergenerational trauma that that has created. Today, in fact, we are farther away from reaching that commitment than ever. At the current growth rate, we will soon see the day when 1 in 4 federal inmates are of Aboriginal heritage. You cannot reasonably claim to have a just society with incarceration rates like these. And most troubling, the growth in the custody population appears to be policy, not crime-driven. After all, crime rates are down while incarceration rates grow. To accommodate this growth, the federal correctional system is working hard to significantly increase cell capacity. Over 2,700 new or renovated cells have been or will soon be added to the federal system at a cost exceeding $650 million. Even still, more than 20% of the population is double bunked, the practice of housing 2 inmates in a cell designed for only 1. As penitentiaries become more crowded, they also become more dangerous and more unpredictable. Use of force incidents are increasing, as are incidents involving the use of restraints and pepper spray. Inmate assaults are up. Segregation placements remain high, as do the rates of inmate complaints and institutional charges. With the increasing pressures and needs and demands on the system, it is not surprising that correctional costs continue to rise. It now costs an average of $110,000 per year to imprison a federal male inmate, and nearly double that to hold a federally sentenced woman in maximum security. Annual health care expenditures now exceed $210 million. The overall budget for CSC is over $2.6 billion, an increase of nearly 40% in the last 5 years. Prison growth and rising correctional costs rarely mean good things. Rather, high and disproportionate incarceration rates for some groups ultimately signifies failures in economic, social, educational, and health policies, failures to treat illness, to create reasonable laws, and to ensure meaningful alternatives to incarceration. A low incarceration rate is a far superior indicator of a safe and just society. It's a paradox that the use of incarceration at the federal level is increasing at the same time crime rates are falling. Overall spending on the Canadian justice system rose 23% between 2002 and 2012. During that same 10-year period, Canada's crime rate fell by exactly the same proportion. Even the United States is backtracking from its war on drugs and tough on crime policies that have proven so ineffective and so costly. The hard-learned lessons from the U.S. experience is that you cannot incarcerate your way to greater public safety. In fact, 1/3 of U.S. states are in the process of closing prison cells, and 2/3 are enacting serious sentencing reforms, reducing sentence length and time served prior to release. There is a reason why human rights must follow a prisoner into prison, why the rule of law does not stop at the prison gate. Correctional practice is governed by a legal framework that empowers the state to only interfere with the life and liberty of the incarcerated to the minimum extent necessary. As the Corrections and Conditional Release Act, that's the law that governs federal corrections, as the CCRA puts it, offenders retain the rights of all members of society except those that are, as a consequence of the sentence, lawfully and necessarily removed or restricted. Imprisonment does not mean the total deprivation or absolute forfeiture of rights. By law, prisoners maintain the right to be treated with dignity and respect. They have the right to the safety and security of the person, to be treated humanely, to not be discriminated against, and to be free from degrading, cruel, or inhumane treatment and punishment. In Canada, human rights and the rule of law define the limits of state authority. In the area of criminal justice, we recognize the authority of the state to punish. However, we must be careful that this authority results in more than simple retribution. Being aware of who is imprisoned and remembering what it is that we hope to accomplish through a sentence of imprisonment must be at the center of our justice system. Constraints must exist so that the state's authority to dispense penalty is not abused. As the old saying goes, offenders are sent to prison as punishment, not for punishment. Our system reflects a desire to reinforce acceptable behavior and sanction the unacceptable. People are incarcerated for a reason. They broke laws. They've hurt others. And there must be a consequence for those actions. Now, it can't be denied that incarceration may serve such interests. That said, society is best served if the consequence supports rather than undermines social cohesion. This is why imprisonment is to be used sparingly and as a last resort. Given that most offenders will eventually be released, the focus must be on the safe, gradual, and timely return of offenders to their community. It's therefore ironic that the time-honored principle of promoting the use of least restrictive measures is being eroded in Canada. The 2012 Safe Streets and Communities Act replaced the language in the CCRA of least restrictive with the much more subjective language of necessary and proportionate. Contrast this with the recently adopted resolution of the U.S. National Association of State Correctional Authorities, where they restated their commitment to and the necessity of using the least restrictive housing and classification options for inmates. This only makes sense. The alternative is to accept and promote the use of more force, more confinement, and more deprivation than is required to achieve your public safety purpose. Promoting and respecting human rights is not somehow about being soft on crime. Respect for human rights is what separates the modern prison as a place of humane detention from a place of torture or abuse. With rising incarceration rates and more offenders spending more times behind bars, there's little evidence that our judicial system has suddenly gone soft, just as there is little evidence that our streets have suddenly become unsafe. I've been in this business for over 30 years. In all that time, I have never met anyone who wants offenders to get away with murder. No one I know wants crimes to go unpunished or criminals to get away scot-free. We want, and our communities deserve, rational, just, and effective consequences to crime that are fairly and humanely administered. This means we must remain committed to the potential of a sentenced person to reform, to restore balance, to make amends, to repair relationships, in the final analysis, to reintegrate. We don't lock them up and throw away the key in Canada. As I've already noted, the majority of inmates will one day rejoin free society. This is why we care about and monitor what goes on behind prison walls. We want them released, ready to participate in that free society. Now, the federal government has been very clear about its law and order agenda. In recent years, this has meant a series of policy and legislative reforms, including, but not limited to, the expansion of mandatory minimum penalties, the reduction of credit for pretrial time served, the tightening or the abolition of some conditional release provisions, and longer waiting periods for pardons, now referred to as criminal record suspensions. A wide-ranging series of offender accountability measures, some linked to the Deficit Reduction Action Plan, have also just been implemented. These changes will mean charging inmates more for making telephone calls from prison, an increase in the room and board deductions that they pay, elimination of incentive pay for work in some prison industries, and the cancellation of some inmate social events and reduced access to prison libraries. In its speech from the throne last month, under the heading Supporting Victims and Punishing Criminals, the government signaled its intention to bring forward legislation that would, and I quote, end the practice of automatic early release for serious repeat offenders, end quote, and to, quote, change the law so that a life sentence means a sentence for life, end quote. Considered together, these measures reflect a narrowing of the rehabilitative potential of corrections. As an ombudsman, it's not my role to pass judgment on the appropriateness of these measures or the language used to justify or defend them. However, if offenders are only ever considered as bad or unredeemable, it's easy for us to lose a grasp of their humanity. Offenders are the only identifiable group in society that we are given permission to hate. The notion that sentenced persons become invisible or are disposable and that punishment with no apparent limits is justified stands many of the principles underlying our democracy and our criminal justice system on their head. Giving primacy to incapacitation and pitting the rights of one group against another has allowed Parliament to create new classes of offenders and offenses to justify longer and harsher sentences. To make sure that inmates are not coddled has meant making prisons more austere, more crowded, more unsafe, and ultimately less effective. We seem to be abandoning proportionality and individualized responses in favor of wholesale retribution and reprisal. If we are to have a just justice system, there can be no contest between whose rights ought to be respected or promoted. Rights do not exist in a vacuum. Human rights are inalienable, not because they have been granted, deserved, or even earned, but rather because they are necessary and an inherent part of being human. They apply equally to all persons, regardless of circumstance. It is relatively easy for the rich and powerful to enjoy their rights, but it's only when the weak, the poor, the disenfranchised, and the imprisoned are seen as equal bearers of rights that all of us can feel secure and entitled. Arbitrary and abusive conditions of detention can only threaten this equilibrium. To say that the rights of crime victims should somehow be ranked against the rights of others is to create a false dichotomy. There can be no hierarchy in the application of human rights. Who would be the most deserving victim, and who would be the least deserving offender? How do you rank order pain about the past or hope about the future? To deny the human rights of offenders is to deny our own. Our rights are shared, and they are inseparable. I cannot enjoy freedom of worship, expression, or assembly without you also enjoying yours. The exercise of my rights does not come at your expense, but rather through respecting my rights, you are empowered to exercise your own. Human rights can only be limited or impaired or restricted with the consent of the governed. Democracies do so sparingly through carefully crafted laws with built-in safeguards protecting the interests of individuals. Human rights are not a veneer. They are the foundation for the rule of law. In a free and democratic society, human rights protect us from the reach and the overwhelming power of the state. A correctional system that is not built upon a foundation of rights is one that undermines the possibility or capacity of offenders to reform and safely resettle in their communities. This is why respect for the human rights of prisoners is not inconsistent with public safety. Rather, it is a precondition for public safety. In the final analysis, the legitimacy of imprisonment relies upon it being used as sparingly as possible. Mass incarceration reflects fear and failure, not hope and justice. A justice system that serves well is one that is characterized by restraint and transparency and balance and fairness. It contains mechanisms that mediate and monitor its powers. Independent oversight is one of those mechanisms, and an informed and engaged public is another. Your being here today is a testament to that. And I want to thank you for being here and for your shared commitment to justice. And I'd like to thank the organizers again for the opportunity to share these reflections with you. I look forward to your questions.